Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the guilty plea for helping wealthy Americans avoid taxes from the second largest Swiss bank, Credit Suisse, whose stock just went up in spite of a $2.6 billion fine. And the too big to jail bank did not have to hand over a list of 22,000 American tax cheaters or fire any top officials. James Henry, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, who is a senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network and a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment, joins us to discuss the contrast of bankers getting away with massive fraud while an Occupy Wall Street protester in New York is sentenced to jail for allegedly striking a plainclothes police officer who grabbed her from behind, a reflexive response for which she was severely beaten by police. Then we'll speak with Joshua Friedman, a policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program at the New America Foundation, where he has a new report at newamerica.net, Pay More, Get Less, How American Socioeconomic Policy is Falling Short. We will discuss how, in terms of a social contract, Americans pay more and receive fewer benefits than citizens in other advanced industrialized nations as prices for health care, higher education, retirement, and other services like banking and the internet increase on a middle class trapped between low stagnant wages and an increasingly expensive set of social and economic supports. Then finally, we'll examine the scandal in the Department of Veterans Affairs over the manipulation of wait times for patients to see physicians and speak with Philip Longman, a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone. He testified last week to the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and we will discuss a healthcare system now embroiled in scandal that, compared to the overall U.S. healthcare system that kills 225,000 Americans per year, is widely recognized as leading the nation in terms of both quality and costs. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is now a senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network and senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be here.
And it seems like we're in a very alternative universe here where Credit Suisse's stock prices go up. In fact, the Swiss Stock Exchange went up as a result of this settlement where they pay $2.6 billion in penalties, but none of their top executives go to jail. And they don't have to hand over the list of 22,000 American tax cheaters.
Yeah, it's a very good deal for the Swiss, and I think that was reflected in the markets. The CEO of Credit Suisse made the remark that this would have a minimal effect on their performance. The chairman of the board, both these guys have been there for years, basically said, we feel white as snow, he said. And, this is just an example, I think, of another round in which the Obama Justice Department, for whatever reason, has kind of dropped the ball when we had an opportunity here, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, because these prosecutions and investigations have been going on since 2009. There are 14 Swiss banks that have had detailed investigations, and there have been a lot more that have been looked at as well. But, all of those could have been corporately indicted or forced to plead. Credit Suisse today did plead in this announcement. They were also allowed to retain their banking license for the Federal Reserve and the Justice Department basically took away with one hand one of the biggest penalties they could have enforced here. So there's no changes at the top. No one is going to jail. This is not a change from the too big to jail policy. And, it turns out that we now have had a parade, really, of major banks involved in all kinds of chicanery, from mortgage fraud, rigging LIBOR, rigging currency markets, money laundering. Some of the largest financial institutions in the world have been you know, engaged in this. And now this latest example, Credit Suisse did it, and this is a relatively mild penalty. It's about three months of Credit Suisse earnings, this fine amounts to. And the stock price appreciation today already made up about half of it.
So this seems to be, though, perhaps a result of the mindset at the Justice Department expressed last year by Attorney General Eric Holder, who said that they were concerned about going after banks in response to criticism that nobody from Wall Street had gone to jail for the 2008 crash. He suggested that you don't want to disrupt the financial system. And also Lanny Brewer, who was in charge of prosecutions, who did nothing and then went on to work for one of the Wall Street banks, he famously exposed himself or his lack of zeal and his fecklessness PBS's frontline by even going further, making apologies for banks. So is there a mindset there that, you know, that we've got to be nice to these guys because they control our economy?
Well, I think it goes beyond that. You know, Holder was the same guy who gave the Mark Rich pardon back in 2000. He then moved to Covington and Burling, where, you know, they represented UBS. Lanny Brewer is not at a Wall Street bank. He is a vice chairman of Covington and Burling. He was in charge of the white-collar crimes department division at the Justice Department. Yes, he did make that statement. You know, if you go back to the 1980s when we had the savings and loan scandal, you know, that was about 1/70th the size of this financial crisis. And this was global. That was really pretty much local. About 880 bankers in the United States were convicted and sent to prison for fraud during that period. Nothing like that has happened on any scale. And so, you know, I think that it reflects partly a change in basic political economy, you know, that you have much more concentrated banks these days. The top four banks in the United States dominate many retail and wholesale banking markets and trading markets, 65 to 70% of the markets, up to 90% in the case of currency markets. And basically, they've gotten larger and more concentrated. And I think that's reflected in the influence they have in Washington. You have the current chief legal counsel of the IRS, you know, a fellow who was a partner at a law firm named Wilmer Hale. And before that, he was a registered representative for the Swiss Bank Association. You know, the head of the U.S. Treasury Department right now is, you know, used to run Citibank's Global Wealth Management Department. Major fundraiser for Obama was the head of UBS America. So there's a lot of different, you know, I think influences here, but there's no question that there's a culture at the top of this administration in particular that's very different from what we've seen in the past. And it's not about, I would argue, it's not about parties. It's not the Democratic Party is corrupt necessarily. It's the gradual accretion of banker influence over time on law enforcement has made it a very unlevel playing field.
So what's happening then with these other cases, with these other Swiss banks? I mean, the whole point of these prosecutions going back to UBS a few years ago was because the IRS wanted the list of American tax cheaters. And yep. I believe that UBS did hand over some, but why did Credit Suisse in this deal not hand over the names of 22,000 U.S. tax cheaters?
Well, I think it was just simply not asked for. It wasn't demanded. They refused, and you know, they could have held them hostage with the banking license. But I mean, I would have thought that was on the table. Holder took it off. you know, there's just simply the lack of will to drive this through to a meaningful penalty. I mean, this has been a very costly investigation for everybody, but we caught them red-handed. We've caught a number of banks. You know, I think all 14 would probably be in the same situation. Their stock prices also appreciated today. You know, so clearly they're reading this as a sign that there will be no disclosures, or that the disclosure process really would take a much longer time, because, you know, there is a process by which, you know, the Justice Department can get access to names, but they have to be very particular about who they're going after, and Swiss are not you know, eager to make this easy. But it could have been handled with a tougher negotiation, and, you know, I think you'd have to ask Holder why that, you know, didn't happen. I mean, I know that Senator Levin, who has been riding herd on the Justice Department and on Holder, had big hearings back in February, was shocked last night when he learned about the terms of the settlement. He did not know. I had to tell their office that the Swiss bank secrecy was being maintained in this deal. And, you know, they were astonished. And both he and Senator McCain, opposite sides of the aisle, but together on this issue of the rule of law, of getting tough on bank secrecy and tax cheating, and distinguishing between tax cutting, which we can argue about, you know, as social policy, from people who basically just declared themselves a zero tax rate and got a Swiss banker to help them take money and hide it abroad.
But what, I mean, this is, what does this say to the average American who pays taxes? I mean, the idea that you can be rewarded for not paying your taxes, that somehow there's some virtue in that. And I know the issue came up in the last presidential election because Romney was paying so little in taxes. But I'm surprised that there isn't more of an outrage. I mean, I know we've had all this propaganda about big government, and mm-hmm. and the whole argument is obviously the wrong one. We should be talking about better government. But nevertheless, there's that canard out there. But I don't understand why it is that people don't recognize. It's like that guy Cliven Bundy, you know, he's got all his armed posse out there posturing as a patriot, and yet he's a moocher, he's a freeloader, he's cattle grazed on government lands and he doesn't pay for it. I mean, what's happening here to the society in general? I think, doesn't this kind of thing erode everybody's basic sense of fairness and trust in the law?
Well, it does. And if you look around the planet at countries that are more developed and more successful, you know, they tend to spend about 25 to 30% of their national incomes on public services, on everything that government does, you know, healthcare and defense and roads and highways and education. You know, we've tried all the alternatives to taxation. We've tried privatization. We have tried debt finance. You know, these alternatives just don't work. So the fact is that we're going to have to find a way to finance that kind of public investment and public services. And if it's not borne by the wealthiest people in the society, the biggest companies are able to, you know, transfer their tax liabilities abroad and avoid taxation. You know, this just becomes a burden for the middle class and the poor. And so I think people need to wake up to the fact we've had 35 to 40 years of tax cuts. I mean, the peak marginal tax rates in the United States back in the late 60s and early 70s, when taxes on incomes were above 70%, corporations were paying 50% taxes. Since then, we've had a global kind of race to the bottom, in which countries have been competing against each other with tax cut after tax cut. And the consequence of that is the public sectors in many places are starved for funds. You know, there has been too little investment in public infrastructure, highways, or, you know, I mean, the United States road system is a nightmare compared to Europe. You have, you know, this track record. We can actually look at it and see, did tax cuts pay off? Have we had a higher growth rate? Have we had more prosperity and real incomes rising? No, the answer is decisively not. So, you know, the issue is this tiny crowd of folks who benefit from tax cutting, you know, I guess they've been euphemistically called the 1%, but they're actually probably more like the 0.1%, you know, have an enormous amount to gain from tax cuts. The rest of us don't. But the other thing that's happened is the political influence and the organization and the concentration of power in that crowd at the top has increased. And so this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is a kind of bankster party that we're up against here. I think we need to really have some, you know, first of all, awareness raising on the part of the American people about what's happening to their democracy here because of the influence of big money and big banks in particular.
And even foreign banks, the Swiss, and now in 2012, the British banks, HSBC, escaped charges from money laundering, you know, Mexican cartel money. I mean, that stuff is criminal. I mean, and here we have in an environment where the IRS is being eviscerated and the Republicans are beating up on it. And after all, you know, the IRS is the only part of the government that actually makes money. I think we should, you know, we should praise them, not damn them.
Well, everybody's in favor of a better managed government. But my point earlier was that we cannot avoid having to finance a certain amount of government service. It's just a necessary part of having a rich country, a developed country, is to have good public services, and it costs money. The basic pattern here that we're up against is that these institutions have no interest in this agenda, and it's quite the opposite.
Right.
So, you know, we have a choice to make. We need to find, I think, ways of getting at, you know, this issue of organizing around it and maybe ultimately thinking about things like breaking up these financial institutions that have become not only too big to fail, but too big to jail.
Well, James Henry, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's now senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network and senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how in America we're paying more and getting less. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Friedman, who is a policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program at the New America Foundation, where he researches and writes about economic and social policy in the U.S. He's the author of the new report at newamerica.net, Pay More, Get Less, How American Socioeconomic Policy is Falling Short. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Friedman.
Thank you for having me.
And your new study, I think it's very groundbreaking and, you know, somewhat overdue. And I can only hope that it really reaches the public's consciousness here, because you're really getting into the whole idea of the American dream and the reality of American life as opposed to the dream. I wouldn't go so far as to say nightmare, but the long and the short of it is our impressions of how we are the leading country in the world with a high standard of living certainly are not supported by the facts, and that across the basic parts of our social contract, such as healthcare, higher education, and retirement, Americans pay more but receive fewer benefits than citizens in other advanced industrialized countries. And the same pattern applies to increasingly important services like banking and the internet. So elaborate, if you will.
Sure, absolutely. So we have this social contract as a society based on wage labor in return for organizing our economy in that way. We have a set of social and economic supports that contribute to a middle class quality of life. And we think of those as healthcare, education, retirement. But additionally, as society grows, some other ones are added to that, like the ability to open a bank account and having access to connections, internet connections, and things like that. And because of the way that we've designed our social and economic programs, which is a very complicated and somewhat regulated, but not all that regulated system, it turns out that we end up paying a lot of money, both at an individual level and at a public level, for these basic goods and services, but are not actually getting that much or as much as we're paying as a result. And you see all the talk about how we spend too much money on this, we spend too much money on that, and that doesn't really get to the heart of the question, which is, what are we actually getting out of it? And one of the things that I was looking at is that we're paying a lot of money, but we're not getting that much. So it can't be a question of us paying too much money. It's a question of how we've designed our systems, how we transmit these benefits to Americans who rely on them increasingly to be the foundation of a middle-class lifestyle.
Well, it seems that we're more invested in the illusion than in the reality because, as you point out, toasters and computers have gotten cheaper and big-screen TVs and all of those consumer goods, which people, of course, since the late 1970s, wages have been stagnant, but access to credit has grown. So that's given the people the illusion of a standard of living. However, having the accoutrement or the toys isn't the same as the fact that middle-class families are trapped between low stagnant wages and increasingly expensive set of social and economic supports as the price of healthcare, higher education, retirement, and other necessities have steadily increased. So that's the bottom line, isn't it? You know, that the real stuff's gotten expensive. We get pay more for less, but we're, you know, for toasters and computers, we pay less. But at the end of the day, that doesn't make a middle class.
Exactly. And one of the common arguments from people who are not very supportive of some of these programs has been that, hey, the middle class is doing just fine. I mean, look at how expensive computers are. They're so much cheaper. They're so much better than they were before. And that's true. But when it comes to the programs that actually make your quality of life better and contribute to economic security, which, as anybody who's in the economy right now can tell you, is tenuous at best, the things that contribute to actual economic security and economic adequacy, those are the things that are getting more expensive or that we're not getting enough results out of the money we spend.
So the real issues are here the need for a safe retirement and affordable post-secondary education and affordable health care, of course. And according to the 2014 Social Progress Index, the U.S. ranks 36th in the world in terms of foundations of well-being, which encompass education, health, and information services. So let's go through some of those. I think it's very disturbing statistics, starting with healthcare, where we pay more for healthcare procedures and pharmaceuticals and medical goods. Here's an example that you have in your paper. An individual procedure such as drugs and MRI cost $1,145 on an average in the United States compared to $138 in Switzerland and $350 in Australia. Nexium, which is a common medication, is $215 in the United States, but only $20 to $60 in parts of Europe. And the cost of spending one day in a hospital in the U.S. is about 10 times higher than in Spain and three times higher than in Australia. These are so important, these statistics. But what worries me, Joshua Friedman, is I don't know that the message is getting out there. I don't think our politicians are talking about this. You know, the Republicans always go out there and say that we have the greatest country on earth, and then the Democrats pay catch-up because they want to be Me Too patriots, and they say the same stuff. So who's educating American people about the reality?
Well, I hope people are reading the paper, but I'm not sure who exactly is thinking about these issues, except to say that when we talk about the, you know, America's the best, one of the main defenses of how much money we spend on these programs is that, well, we have higher quality, you know, we get better outcomes. But for the most part, that's actually not true. In some cases, like higher education, our very top universities, the ones that are world famous, yes, those are the best in the world. But for the rest of the system, for all of these, whether it's healthcare or higher education or retirement or any of them, we don't actually have results that are seemingly better. We just have less access. So when we talk about healthcare, right, we have these prices are so high, people are paying more, but you're not actually getting more for that. If, whether it's Nexium you're getting in the UK or Nexium you're getting here, the same thing. We're just paying through the roof for it.
So let's turn to education. The U.S. spends far more on higher education than the OECD average, as the European countries, and more per student than any other country. The U.S. spends $22,744 per student on higher education in 2010, while the OECD average was $9,274.
So, yeah, I mean, anybody who's has to put a child through college or has been to college recently can tell you education, especially higher education in the U.S., is very expensive. And that goes both at the individual level, where tuition is rising and student debt is going up, as well as at the public level, where the government has stepped in, and because education is an important priority for individuals and for the country as a whole, has made it a priority to subsidize education. But as a proponent of education, I think that's important. It's just the question of how we do it, and I think it's a fairly strong argument to say that what we've done is sort of just added more fuel to this fire of subsidizing students to go to schools that are increasingly expensive. And again, the quality that you get out of it, in some cases, the education is better, but that only applies to a very small subset of the population. For most students at most of these schools, you see tuition going up, you see government subsidy going up, but in terms of results of how many people are educating and in terms of what kind of quality education they're getting, it really, I don't think the data supports an idea that we're doing better. If anything, we're doing substantially worse.
Well, we know that student debt is higher than household debt, and it's growing, and then we have generations of students now that are in effect indentured. But right. when you say that the education is subsidized in this country, one of the things that I find appalling is the for-profit college industry, which is a racket, which is a result of our corrupt politics in Washington, where these lobbyists buy prominent Democrats and prominent Republicans and basically get bills passed to rip off the taxpayer. So we as taxpayers subsidize the for-profit college industry to the tune of about $30 to $40 billion a year. And they just rip off these kids, give them worthless diplomas and indention to life, and spend a fortune on advertising on television with your and my taxpayers' money. I mean, isn't our money-driven politics a factor in why we pay more and get less?
I think it is. I don't think it's quite so simple as large amounts of money are swaying politics directly. But certainly in the education sphere, the higher education lobby that promotes the status quo in terms of how universities operate, they do have a lot of sway. But in general, I mean, you're always going to get a political system in which there are powers in that are going to push certain buttons. I think the bigger issue is just that we've gone so far down a certain path, and the response to trying to fix these issues for the politicians who do recognize that this social contract is a big issue and that people are struggling economically, the response has been to kind of add on more programs at the bottom or like put little band-aids or patches on it, which does a little bit to help some people in the short term, but adds to the overall complexity of the system and how many, you know, end around turns and twists and opportunities there are for rent seeking, for people to kind of extract money out of it, take money for not really contributing to a better product. And that's a big part of why we see high costs and mediocre results. The systems are just very complicated, and the solutions to fixing the systems only add to the complexity rather than try to make them more understandable, more simple, and more direct to what they're trying to achieve.
But Joshua Friedman, you also talk about how in terms of basic financial services, where a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, they find basic financial services are very high. And that has led, for example, to the proliferation of payday lenders who are another example of what I was talking about earlier with the for-profit college. They have a powerful lobby in Washington. General Petraeus's wife managed to get the military, or get the Congress to pass a bill, you know, shooing these predators away from military bases where they were preying on soldiers and getting them indentured. And that, again, is an example of where, you know, our government's empowering bottom feeders but not dealing with, you know, making life for the middle class and working Americans better.
I agree with you, Ian, and I will add one thing, though, is that if you look at what payday lenders are doing, in a lot of cases, the alternative to some of these payday lenders who do have very, very high costs and fees and interest rates that are through the roof, the alternative for many people in certain communities is not that much better. The other banks that are there, the especially large banks, either don't offer services or offer sort of hidden fees that are similar and end up costing the same amount for people who have sort of volatile incomes or unstable finances. Even using regular banking products can be just as bad as using payday lending. But we've done nothing to actually try to fix that problem. One of the main responses has been to try to subsidize banks to do more of what they aren't otherwise doing in terms of offering products to low-income families. But that, again, just drives up costs. And at the end of the day, I don't think what we've seen is that that has been successful. What we see is just the rise of both payday lending and complex programs to try to convince banks to get into the low-income lending market rather than perhaps offering more direct, safer, maybe a public banking option, like a postal savings bank, for example, that could...
Which we used to have, by the way, Joshua, until the 1960s. Yeah.
And during the Great Depression, it was a big source of stability for families, and it did fade over time. Other countries do still have a postal banking system, some designed better than others, but certainly there are options for trying to tackle these problems in ways that would more directly address the problems that we see.
So let's turn to retirement and a safe retirement. Only 14% of all private sector workers have access to any kind of defined benefit pension, and that's down from 38% in 1979. So we're clearly heading in the wrong direction.
Well, so what we've seen is the overall number of people with access to any type of retirement plan has stayed the same. What's happened is that companies have shifted from defined benefit plans, where people get a specific pension payout monthly or annually at the end, and exchange that for defined contribution plans, where people have to put in the money themselves, put the money into markets or bonds or some investments, and then they just take out whatever is there. So what that does is it shifts the risk. The risk that was originally on the entire company is now on each individual. And if something goes wrong, the individual suffers. There's no risk pooling, or much less risk pooling than there would otherwise be. And so what you get is that system turns out to be a lot more costly for individuals, because if something goes wrong, there's nothing they can do, and it requires a much more time and effort and potentially, you know, taking on that risk of putting your money in the market or some other investment vehicle. And yeah, defined benefit pensions themselves had problems because they are expensive for employers. However, certainly safer for individuals. And if we're talking about economic insecurity, the amount of risk that individuals are taking on and the amount of fees that Wall Street middlemen or financial advisors have taken trying to reallocate individual people's funds adds to the overall cost of the system. So people are spending a greater share of their retirement savings paying for people to invest their retirement rather than actually having them be safe in funds somewhere.
Well, let's just turn in the last couple of minutes then to the private sector. We've talked about banking, of course, which used to be, at least in terms of post offices, in the public sector. And the post office, of course, is going broke, so it could probably do with a bit of a boost there. I know Bernie Sanders has been trying to reintroduce post office banking. But the other thing that I think most of our listeners know about, and we're watching Time Warner and Comcast merge, and now AT&T and DirecTV emerge, and yet in internet services, we are poster boys here in the United States for the pay more, get less model. At the highest internet speeds in the U.S., the U.S. pays more than three times that of most of our peers and twice that of the OECD average. And anybody that has a cable package knows what lousy service you get and how they keep billing you for more. And if that model, if they get rid of net neutrality and they cableize the internet altogether, then we will truly, the country that invented the internet, will go back into the dark ages. I know I'm being a little dramatic here, but those are the facts.
I don't want to overuse anecdotes, but I know that when I was thinking about switching internet providers a few years ago, I looked at the cost and I was just shocked at what I thought were absurd prices that were charged for very basic services, nothing fancy, just basic, you know, decent speeds for a household of people. And it's true, we have very high prices, and our speeds are not better, our quality is not better necessarily than other countries. And it gets a little complicated in some of the differences because the U.S. has a very large area and a very spread out population in places. So there are some issues, but I think it's pretty clear that the lack of a sufficient regulatory system to ensure fair prices and to make sure access is being widely distributed has contributed to the higher prices and not great service.
So just in conclusion then, Joshua Friedman, nearly every other peer nation outperforms the U.S. in terms of both public services and private services, in effect, where we pay more and get less. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. And I think that you don't want to overuse comparisons, but it's pretty clear that other places have figured out on these various issues how to provide them more effectively than we have. And, you know, for a country that wants to promote its middle class, wants to ensure economic security for more people, this is not some random crazy idea, because the fact that almost everywhere has done it more effectively than us should serve as a clear sign that it is something that we wanted to do if we were to make the effort to design our programs much more simply, directly, and effectively.
But today there are primary elections going on in 6 states. Most of the debates are about the most extraneous, insane stuff that you can imagine. The New York Times has a very stinging editorial about it on Tuesday, indicating the absurdity of our political debate, where, you know, they're talking about denying global warming and obsessions with abortion, etc. Isn't that, at the end of the day, a part of the problem? That in the social democracies that you reference here, the OECD countries, people vote for public services, and if the government maintains these services and are good stewards of their money, they vote them back in. If they don't, they vote them out. In this country, we vote for people who don't do a damn thing for us, but distract us with all kinds of, you know, ideological and religious things like abortion. I mean, that's the part of it that I don't understand.
I don't know if I agree with you on this one. I think that other countries also have their political problems. If you look at, you know, France and the right-wing parties that are gaining traction there right now with Le Pen and some of the others, they certainly have their crazy issues as well. And if you look at the U.S. systems, the social programs and economic programs that we do have that are working well, things like Social Security, which has very low overhead costs and provides a majority of retirement income for a decent chunk of the senior population, those programs, if a politician threatens to even think about cutting them, they're immediately like kicked off the stage. So we do have some ability through our political system to, you know, keep in place the programs that are working. The issue, though, is trying to implement new programs. I don't think that people have any interest in actually recalibrating the programs, or they do have an interest in fighting about other things. The abstract size of the government, for example, which the abstract size, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't make sense because it doesn't say anything about what we're actually getting or what we actually need. So instead of concentrating on how big the government or how small the government, we should concentrate on what kind of services and social protections and ways of providing economic security the government can do effectively, and then ensuring that the people who need these services, which at this point is the broad middle class, to boost their quality of life, making sure that the government actually is doing it in an effective manner.
Well, if we had an effective opposition to the Republicans in this country who keep talking about big government, and if the Democrats would talk about, no, that's a canard, let's talk about better government, maybe we'd be getting somewhere.
I agree with you, and I would hope that we can have that debate at some point. But obviously the small government talking points seem to continue to be effective, despite, I think, just standing in the way of actually getting to a better system.
Well, Joshua Friedman, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the VA healthcare system, now embroiled in a scandal that compared to the overall U.S. healthcare system that kills 225,000 Americans a year, is widely recognized as leading the nations in terms of both quality and costs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Philip Longman, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and the New America Foundation, as well as the author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone, now in its third edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Longman.
Great to be here, Ian.
And last week you testified before the United States Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Where was the scandal burgeoning now then, and were you addressing that, or was the committee looking into that?
Yes, it was a committee held to investigate the allegations about cooking the books on scheduling of appointments for veterans.
But your book and your testimony basically is talking about how the VA health system is a good model. It works, and it's furthermore a good model for the rest of America. So how do you reconcile all of the recriminations coming back and forth now over the wait times and cooking the books and mm-hmm. the basic thesis of your book?
Well, important question to ask always when things come up about the VA is compared to what? So we have a problem here in the VA, and people are looking into it. But, you know, we have to remember that the U.S. healthcare system as a whole is extremely dangerous and unsafe. So that, you know, a standard estimate now is that due to medical errors, unnecessary or avoidable hospital infections and other forms of bad medicine, we're losing about 250,000 people a year, which makes contact with the U.S. healthcare system the third leading cause of death in the United States, after all cancer and all heart disease. So when you're aware of how lethal our healthcare system is as a whole, the context of maybe 40 veterans having died while on some waiting list takes on a different cast. So if you were at the hearings, you would have heard one veterans group after another come up and extol the virtues of VA healthcare, whether they were talking about the American Legions or any of the other groups. What they will say, and I agree with it, is that we do have a problem with access to care. There's too much paperwork and red tape involved in establishing eligibility, and we need to work on that. But for those, for the vets that get into VA healthcare, it literally is best care anywhere by all kinds of different metrics. So that's my basic take on this. That we have work to do, but we still, the rest of the healthcare system really has a lot to learn from the VA.
So, Philip Longman, then, is this more of a political issue than a real public health problem? I mean, it's sort of reminiscent, the calls for the Obama White House to fire General Shinseki, similar to the calls for him to fire Kathleen Sebelius after the botched launch of healthcare.gov. And it does seem that the president is somewhat, caught by surprise by a bureaucracy that he doesn't seem to control or be aware of its deficiencies.
Well, the VA managers have received warnings from different quarters over the years that the scheduling issue was a problem. You would like to think that they would have been able to solve it. But the context here is the VA, unlike the rest of the U.S. healthcare system, actually pays attention to the quality of its healthcare and tries to develop metrics. And guess what? In a great giant organization with 270,000 employees, some people try and game those metrics. And that's what's happened here. Whether it's happened in just isolated incidents or more broadly, still need to be investigated. But it's a problem that in any institution, when you say, here are your performance measures, here's how we're going to evaluate you, certain people will try and game that system. So you need to come up with some kind of check and balance against that, or just tolerate a certain amount of gaming. Again, though, outside of the VA, most healthcare systems don't make any effort at all to manage their scheduling times. So most people in most places in the United States would have to wait weeks or months to find a primary care doctor who's still taking new patients. You know, we have a pandemic problem of doctor shortages throughout the American healthcare system. So again, you know, it comes down to the question of compared to what. I personally don't know enough to be able to say whether General Szczesny should resign. I think he's very much in earnest in trying to solve this problem, and I think he is trying to solve it. It's a difficult one to solve.
So, in your testimony before the United States Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs last week, May the 14th, Philip Longman, you mentioned here that the Veterans Benefit Administration must accept blame for not doing better job of streamlining administrative procedures. But in all fairness, it is the Congress, and by extension, the American people as a whole, who have established the laws that require most vets to prove that they have service-related disabilities before becoming eligible for VA care. So explain that further.
Well, I'm glad you brought that out. So for many, many years, for example, people who fought in Vietnam, when they came home and developed various ailments, would have to prove that those ailments were somehow related to service in Vietnam. A lot of them, you know, were exposed to Agent Orange, the defoliant that was used there. And it took a long time for the science to come in and definitively establish that, for example, exposure to Agent Orange would bring on early onset Parkinson's disease, right? 30 years later, the science finally came in to establish that, yes, indeed, when you're exposed to Agent Orange, you're quite likely to develop Parkinson's disease in your 50s and 60s. We spent just inordinate amounts of time and all kinds of heartache forcing vets to prove that, for example, their Parkinson's disease was a result of exposure to Agent Orange. And after all, how do you prove a thing like that? How do you prove that, oh, yes, it was this day 30 years ago, I was walking in the jungles of Vietnam and a mist came down upon me, and that's why I have Parkinson's disease today. Every day we have the administrative courts here in Washington, D.C., are filled with cases of a kind like a veteran has hearing loss. Is it because of the artillery fire he was exposed to during the Vietnam War or Korea? Or is it because of all the Who concerts you listened to in the 1960s? And it's just a sort of ridiculous question that nobody could adjudicate, even if they knew all the facts. And yet we force veterans to try and prove these kind of things. So it would be much better if we just had a system that says, you know what, if you served your country, thank you, here's your health care. And that actually is how the VA has worked for different periods in its over time. But right now, we're still in the mode of forcing veterans to to prove things that are essentially unprovable about whether their maladies are a result of service-related illness or not.
Well, as bad as that is, Philip Longman, it would seem that the more recent wars like Iraq and Afghanistan, because of improvements to emergency medicine and battlefield medicine, more and more severely wounded people are surviving, certainly infinitely more than happened in World War II, for example. And these are injuries that are manifest. You can, you know, people who have lost limbs and half of their head blown off. That must be the most expensive care imaginable. Is that what's happening? That so much of the resources are now going to these new injuries?
Actually, you'd be surprised how little money that costs because there's so few individuals affected. I mean,
that's true. The casualties are
a horrible number, right? But if you went into a VA hospital today, anywhere in the country, maybe 7% of the patients there would even be veterans of the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Most of the people are much older. They're World War II vets, Korean vets, right? So first of all, just in terms of who's in the hospital, that's not a load. I've visited many polytrauma units around the VA system where there's plenty of space. It's incredibly expensive to deal with someone who's a quadriplegic, and it's a very high specialty care, and yes, it costs a lot of money, but that's not the reason we're having scheduling problems at all. In terms of either crowding out money or time or facilities or anything like that. We have a lot of people presenting with things, traumatic brain injury, where, a lot of guys come home and they know maybe that they suffered some kind of concussion, say from a landmine, right? But at the time they felt fine, right? Or they bounced back fairly well. And the symptoms of that only show up much, much later. Basically, you're talking about many hairline fractures and capillaries in the skull. We don't really know much about the science at all. So now, to say to those guys 15 years from now, oh, well, you present with mental illness. Is that because of this traumatic brain illness, or is that just because of life's been unfair to you or some genetic thing? I mean, again, this is like a ridiculous thing to put a veteran through, right? Why are you an alcoholic at age 50? Is it because this, that, or the other thing? Is it service-related or not? Who knows, right? So that's why we need to really open up this system. The good news is that by basically every metric, the quality of care in the system for those who are getting it is higher than outside the system. It's also more cost-effective. So the more people we can get being treated in the VA as opposed to the rest of the system, the more money we save and the more people get high quality care. So it really should be a no-brainer. But we do get distracted by these kind of scandals and get blown out a lot of proportion, and people want to use them to make ideological points about how socialized medicine can't work and like that.
The Republicans are always looking for ways to beat up on Obama and the Democrats, whether it's Fast and Furious or the Benghazi phony scandal or the IRS phony scandal. So it's not surprising they're jumping on this. But what mechanism exists within the VA that makes these decisions that essentially says to the vet, we're not sure you're telling us the truth, and prove that you were doused by Agent Orange in Vietnam and prove that the IED that blew up your vehicle has caused your brain damage. So, in other words, why...
What mechanisms do we have for
that? Yeah, I guess the motive behind it is, let me put it another way. How many vets show up that are just trying to game the system?
Who have illnesses that aren't related to...
In other words, why have this screening procedure? It assumes that you have a problem, that people are lying to you. And my understanding is that people aren't lying to them. They're just making people jump through hoops unnecessarily.
Well, I think that's right. And in the case of, well, I profiled a poor guy who was out in Fargo, North Dakota. He worked in a, he'd been in Vietnam. He'd been exposed to Agent Orange. At age 58, he developed Parkinson's disease. The new literature suggested that exposure to Agent Orange was associated with early onset Parkinson's disease. He presented to the VA hospital in Fargo, and the bureaucrats there told him, well, didn't you work in a chemical factory all your years since Vietnam? Maybe it's the chemicals in the chemical factory that caused your Parkinson's. And so he had to litigate that. And now, the good news on Parkinson's and Agent Orange is the same General Senzeki out of the VA has changed the rules as of, I think, about 2 years ago. So now there's a presumption that if you were in Vietnam and you were exposed to Agent Orange, if you were in Vietnam and you now have Parkinson's disease, there's a presumption that that is because of exposure to Agent Orange and you have eligibility to VA health care. And that, by the way, is something that is crowding the VA. All these guys now with Parkinson's were now able to come into the VA. But that's an example of the kind of thing we need to do more of, right, is to say, look, let's use our resources actually treating folks instead of trying to answer these kind of metaphysical questions about what particular disease of aging is the one that is related to your military service or not. And I don't think there's a lot of cheating.
Right.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm assuming there isn't. I just don't understand why these bureaucratic impediments are put in place. Just in closing then, Philip Longman, back to the scandal du jour, do you think that, given the sort of election year politics and the fact that the Republicans, people like Daryl Issa don't do anything else but try and manufacture scandals, that there'll be any value to these latest inquiries? I mean, all of the Obama people are saying how outraged they are, et cetera, and they've made that pretty clear. But on the so I guess the question is, is anything good going to come from this?
Well, I think some good can come from this. It's unlike, in my opinion, say Fast and Furious, this is a real scandal, right? Or has every appearance of it. In that, it's every appearance that some people in the field did some very bad things, including criminally negligent things. And some people may need to go to jail for this, right? But if we can root those people out of the system, that's good. And if we can come up with safeguards that prevent that kind of cheating in the future, or have a more nuanced understanding of how best to manage people so that we don't sort of coerce them into gaming the system, this would be VA employees, right? That's all good that can come out of this. But what will be bad is if people think, that just goes to show you what happens when government gets involved in healthcare, right? Because the larger context is that the VA is outperforming the rest of the U.S. healthcare system by leaps and bounds, and we need to make the rest of the healthcare system more like the VA rather than assuming that its occasional shortfalls prove anything large. Just remember, your local hospital, there's no inspector general mm-hmm. overlooking your local hospital. There's no committees of Congress that overlook your local hospital. There's no broad-based citizens organizations, comparable to the American Legion, that overlook your local hospital. VA gets all kinds of incredible public scrutiny, right? And yes, stuff gets revealed that way. But you're much safer at the VA than you would be away from where that scrutiny is everywhere.
Well, Philip Longman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Philip Longman, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and the New America Foundation, as well as the author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone, now in its third edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.